coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Do we in our time have an answer to the question of what we really mean by the word being?
The Life and Thought of Martin Heidegger.
Our aim in the following treatise is to work out the question of the meaning of being and to do so concretely.
Heidegger's Being and Time is both undoubtedly important and virtually unreadable.
In der Welt sein.
Being in the world.
Sein zum Tode.
Being toward death.
Geworfenheit.
Thrown ahead in a sausage. Great philosophical concepts or mere impenetrable jargon?
There are two uncontestable facts about Heidegger.
Our guest is Thomas Sheehan, author of Making Sense of Heidegger.
One is that he was a brilliant philosopher. The other was that he was a nefarious Nazi.
Heidegger's troubled relationships, from Husserl to Sartre to Hannah Arendt.
The Life and Thought of Martin Heidegger, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thank you for being a Philosophy Talk partner.
We're grateful for your past support. We need you to stand up and help us again, now more than ever. And you can do so just by heading over to the Philosophy Talk webpage and clicking that big I Will Help button. And believe me, it will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
Now today, we're thinking about the philosophy and life, the life and thought of Martin Heidegger.
One of my favorite philosophers, Ken.
Oh, come on, John. You are kidding me. Surely you're kidding me. Heidegger is the continental philosopher that analytically trained philosophers like you and me both. We love to hate that guy.
Well, Ken, I admit that was my attitude for a long time. And I'm exaggerating a little in calling him a favorite. He's not up there with Hume.
I'm glad to hear that, John.
But Kevin Ginn, a graduate student at UC Riverside, convinced me to take another look at Heidegger. And with his help, I'm getting a bit of sense of what Heidegger was all about, and I'm finding it very interesting.
Yeah, like das Nichtstehen, you find that interesting? I don't even know what that means. Or maybe it's Dasein you think is so cool.
Well, das Nichtstehen in English means nothing nuts. That perhaps isn't yet quite clear. We don't want to spend a lot of time talking about nothing. So let's talk about Dasein. I think that's a much more interesting, or at least a much more accessible idea of Heidegger's. You and I are Daseins. Rocks aren't. Lizards aren't. Most other animals aren't. But we are.
Okay, Daseins. Human beings are Dasein. Why didn't he just say, well, I want to talk about human beings. What's with the Dasein thing?
Well, I think the special terminology being there gets at his idea that that's where human beings start out. We're thrown into the world. We're part of the world. We're not something. Anyway, it's supposed to contrast, say, with a Cartesian point of view. A Cartesian ego is basically just a thinker, an observer, an immaterial entity who reasons from its own existence and ideas to God's existence and hence to the world and other people. The starting point is an immaterial soul and its ideas. Heidegger rejects all that. For Descartes, the struggle is to justify belief in the rest of the world, but not for Heidegger.
Wait a minute. Is Heidegger saying that if I'm a Dasein, then I'm not a thinker and an observer? That doesn't sound so
No. Heidegger doesn't deny that we think and observe. But for him, seeing yourself as a mind that's separate from the world, like Descartes does, can only be the result of an intellectual struggle. It's not the starting point of human life or of philosophy. For Heidegger, the world isn't presented to me through my ideas. As Dasein, I'm basically in the world. I'm basically an agent and a doer, fully immersed in the world and using various of its parts as tools for my projects.
I don't get it, John. I mean, isn't having a mind that can represent, you know, represent the outside world and form ideas about it and have thoughts about it, isn't that what makes us different from rocks and even from lizards that just stick out its tongues at things?
No. The basic difference isn't that rocks and lizards are immersed in the world and you're some kind of Cartesian ego that's not. Rocks simply persist through time. animals, and plants too for that matter, react to circumstances in order to survive and reproduce. But humans lead lives. They form projects. They have goals, and they make choices about how to achieve them. And the world comes in as tools that as providing tools that they use for those activities.
Well, you know, okay, I'm going to try and be more open-minded than I was taught to be about Heidegger. You know, he sounds sort of, kind of, maybe a little bit like a naturalist. I'm a card-carrying naturalist, card-carrying member of the Naturalistic Party. We think consciousness, intentionality, thought, all that stuff is just part of nature immersed in the material world and not really separate from it. Is that kind of what he's thinking?
Well, you're having an insight, Ken, although I wouldn't want to overdo it. I mean, Heidegger's, you don't find a lot of talk in Heidegger about evolution and biology and humans being part of all that. But I think he has this insight, this position that naturalists have to have, which is that we are part of the world, and all of our thinking and all of our philosophy and all of our literature is ultimately grounded in this very basic relationship that we have to things when we use them in our projects. So he agrees with the naturalist, I think, in a fundamental way.
Well, that's cool. That sounds kind of cool. I can get around that. But there's one thing, you know, it's one thing you sort of left out. The guy was a Nazi. Come on, how can we be talking about a Nazi?
Well, it makes me a little bit uncomfortable that Heidegger was a member of the Nazi Party, but then good ideas are where you find them. All I really know, I'm not a scholar about this, Heidegger did join the Nazi Party in the early 30s, probably as a condition or as a part of becoming rector at the University of Freiburg, which he wanted to do. He gave up that job not too long after that. In the meantime, people disagree about whether he was an enthusiastic Nazi or a reluctant and somewhat opportunistic dupe.
Well, you know, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to find out about this dark side of Heidegger. She files this report.
In 1925, Martin Heidegger was a philosophy professor in Freiburg, Germany. And he was quite the superstar.
Heidegger was a real celebrity when he was a young professor in his 30s.
That's Joshua Rothman, an editor at The New Yorker. He says Heidegger was a really charismatic guy.
As a young professor, people had a fervent admiration for Heidegger, and students, you know, fell under his spell.
Including female students, like 19-year-old Hannah Arendt.
She was an undergraduate student in his philosophy class, and he sent her a note being like, we should meet.
More specifically, Heidegger wrote,
"Dear Miss Arendt, I must come to see you this evening and speak to your heart. I will never be able to call you mine, but from now on, you will belong in my life."
That led to their affair, even though Heidegger was married. But let's step back a few years. Heidegger was born in rural Germany in 1889. In university, he studied philosophy, and by 1923, Heidegger was the intellectual star of Germany. 2 years later, his affair with Hannah Arendt began. But that ended when Arendt fled Germany. The Nazi Party had risen to power, and she was Jewish.
Shortly after that, you know, Heidegger became a Nazi.
In uns selbst allein liegt die Zukunft des deutschen Volkes.
When Hitler came to power, Heidegger got promoted. He became the president of the university.
Heidegger embraced the Nazi Party. When his esteemed mentor, Edmund Husserl, got fired from Freiburg University for being Jewish, Heidegger did nothing to defend him. He also denied financial aid to non-Aryan students. After the war ended, the Nazi Party fell, and Heidegger fell from grace. But his Jewish lover from almost two decades earlier came to his defense.
A big reason why Heidegger's reputation survived being a Nazi is because Hannah Arendt defended him, because he did very little to defend himself or to apologize for his membership in the Nazi Party during the war.
Heidegger remained pretty much silent on the subject.
Hannah Arendt, in defending him, essentially argued like that he was politically stupid and he was bad at politics, but he was great at philosophy. This was sort of the idea.
But Rothman says that's a weak argument.
It's hard to say of someone who is supposed to be a genius that they just got swept up in it because they weren't thinking very clearly.
Especially after Heidegger's secret memoir, the so-called Black Notebooks, were published in 2014.
So he wrote in these black notebooks his whole life, and he, before he died, set up a schedule of publication for the notebooks.
The final notebooks published were the ones he wrote during World War II, in which he used his own philosophy to make anti-Semitic statements.
He'll say, well, you know, Jews are a naturally calculating race, and like more so than other people, you know, they're less good at authentic being because they actually, in some sense, embody the modern impulse towards making use of everything that you see around you.
Rothman says that raises a big question.
Does it mean that intrinsically Heidegger's ideas are bad, that they can be used in this bad way? So, you know, I tend to think Heidegger took his own thoughts and he screwed them up, but it doesn't mean that his original thoughts weren't good.
Joshua Rothman admits, it's hard to read Heidegger and ignore his racist politics, but it's also a shame to disregard Heidegger's philosophy because of his politics. Martin Heidegger himself once said, "He who thinks great thoughts often makes great errors." Maybe he was talking about himself. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks for that report on a difficult and distressing subject, Shuka. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford Dasein, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about, actually we're skillfully coping with, the philosophy of Martin Heidegger. We're joined now by Thomas Sheehan. He's professor of religious studies at Stanford. He's author of Making Sense of Heidegger, A Paradigm Shift. Tom, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Good morning, John and Ken.
Good morning, Tom. Now, we're going to mostly talk about Heidegger's good ideas, I hope, but let's talk a little bit about this Nazism just to get it out of the way, I hope. You were really one of the first to focus our attention on this issue back in the 70s. Now these diaries that document a long-standing anti-Semitism have been unearthed. Still, it's clear that you think Heidegger was a profound philosopher well worth our attention. So give us a hint. How should we fit all of this together in our mind in a way that makes sense?
Well, that's an excellent question, John. I think we have to distinguish between the biography and the philosophy. And we have to find out whether the biography, which includes Nazism and anti-Semitism, hemorrhages into the philosophy at all. This is not just Heidegger's problem. I mean, one thinks, for example, the anti-Semitism of Frege, which is found in his notebooks. Does that hemorrhage into his philosophy or not? Not to mention, of course, Kant, Hegel, and other anti-Semites in the German tradition. In any case, Heidegger was a very conservative nationalist. He supported the Nazis from at least 1931 to 1934, and idiosyncratically up until the end of the World War, 1945. We can attribute it to his conservatism, his nationalism, the defeat in World War I, a whole bunch of things. But it doesn't absolve him as a philosopher from the bad decisions that he made. My question is, how do we read the philosophy now that we know about his most despicable convictions?
Well, let's move to that philosophy now. Now, as a admittedly analytic philosophy in a 21st century that's probably outgrown the analytic continental shift, knowing much less about continental philosophers than we expect graduate students do now, I learned two things about Heidegger. He said nothing nuts, which doesn't make much sense on the surface, and which Rudolf Carnap, a hero of analytical philosophers, used as a paradigm example of meaningless, unverifiable gibberish characteristic of metaphysics. But on the other hand, he invented the word Dasein, and that seems a lot more promising, as we discussed in the opening remarks. So let's not talk about nothing. Let's talk about Dasein. How far off was Ken and my discussion at the beginning?
No, it was quite a good discussion, I would say. And there's no question Heidegger uses weird language. So, of course, did Aristotle, who invented all sorts of neologisms like entelecheia and other things like that. But I would be in favor of throwing out the window such words as Dasein. They make no sense. They're a German word. Why don't we speak English here?
But he wrote in German.
He certainly wrote in German.
Does it make sense to a German reading Heidegger?
Absolutely. Once you understand what he's getting at, the word Dasein means existence in German, like the existence of God. Kant talks about the Dasein Gottes. Heidegger goes to the etymology of the word, and it means to stand out ahead, to be thrown open as an arena of sense-making. So I say throw out the word Dasein. Let's use the word existence, putting a little hyphen in there, and let's just simply say it. The nature of the human being is to be thrown open for purposes of meaning.
Well, that sounds like a profound thought. I'm not quite sure what it means to be thrown open for the purposes of meaning.
Well,
but it sounds very profound. Can you do it briefly?
Yeah, I would like to say, what is consciousness? What is mind? It's not within our heads. Mind, psyche, Aristotle said, is all over the world. You're thrown out upon things. That's what we're representing, stuff like that. That's what he's getting at with Dasein.
Okay, we'll have to explore that in more depth. Like I said, it sounds like a profound notion. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Martin Heidegger with Thomas Sheehan, author of Making Sense of Heidegger.
Are you a Cartesian ego, or a Dasein, or just a Giants fan, or just a Warriors fan, or just a sports fan of some team not in the Bay Area?
Heidegger, Hammers, and the Human Condition, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning, I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about the philosophy of Martin Heidegger.
Our guest is Thomas Sheehan from Stanford University, author of Making Sense of Heidegger.
So, Tom, I want to go back to Dasein, but let's take another avenue in, because I know, again, I'm no Heidegger scholar by any means, but I know Heidegger has this thing about skillful coping and tools and all this sort of stuff, and the philosopher Hubert Dreyfus makes a lot about hammers as a parade example of our relationship to being, as our relationship to Dasein. Can you explain what's the big deal with Heidegger's hammers and Heidegger is?
Yeah, I think that's been really exaggerated. Heidegger has probably 500 words on hammers in Being and Time.
But it's still an important idea, right?
Well, it's important as an example. What he really means to get at is that in any action, any praxis, we're looking ahead to the task to be done, to the action to be performed. And the hammer is just an example of carpentry. We're looking forward to building a house, right? That's our goal. A hammer is a means to that. And if there's no hammer available, maybe we'll use a rock to pound in a nail. The point is means, ends. And Heidegger says we are thrown ahead to our purposes, our ends, and our goals. That's the thrown open, thrown aheadness that I referred to earlier. Any kind of tool is looking forward to that for the purpose of which it's being used.
So this is part of his thing about, as I understand it, tell me if I'm right. This is his thing about the world, right? Because once you start thinking about that, you get a whole network of these relationships. Mm-hmm. And a Dasein is a being embedded in a world with these tools that are this thrown aheadness thing you're talking about. But this thrown aheadness gets to be a really big, all-encompassing set of relations or something.
Yes, I would agree with John's earlier remarks. Heidegger definitely was a naturalist. There's no question about that. And he does talk about biology and evolution in his courses in the 1920s and 30s. So he's a naturalist. However, the world that he's talking about is the real world that you and I live in, which is a world of meaning, not just of things, right? So when he says being in the world, he means being within a world of meaning that gives its significance to hammers, to rocks, to whatever we happen to be using, pens, pencils, etc. So being in the world means being ahead in a meaning-giving purpose, right? The purpose that I'm driving at is what gives meaning to the hammer that I use. This one may not work, that one does. So that's what he's driving at. We live ahead in purposes, meaning-giving purposes, and that's where the so-called being of the hammer comes from. We should throw out the word being as we throw out the word Dasein. It means the significance of the hammer.
So as I understand it, I mean Heidegger, though conservative politically, was an atheist, I mean, I think.
Yes, philosophically he certainly was. He had no way to find God in his philosophy.
Yeah, so meaning isn't something that comes to us from God. It's something we give to the universe because we have these active purposes that the meaning, I mean, in the philosophy of action, you have the means as you do this by doing that, and by doing that, you do this other, and so forth and so on.
Right, exactly.
And that's our primary conception of the world. But now, as I understand Heidegger, that's only kind of stage one. At least if you're a philosopher, you get beyond that to something a bit more theoretical.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. What he's interested in is the gap between here and there, between me and my purposes. That's called discursivity, mediation. I don't have an intellectual intuition of the meaning of a hammer, right? I have to run through things. I have to discursively see what the project is and whether the hammer will fit. What he's interested in is that gap. That's what he means, John, by nothing. And when he says nothing, nothing's bad translation, it means that nothing is operative. That gap is operative. We should pay attention to that as well as to the two things on either side of it, the subject and the predicate or the tool and the task.
Now my understanding is that when you fail, when your hammer breaks, that's the beginning of this reflection. I think that's why I became a philosopher, because I spent a lot of time earning money hammering things, but it was usually my thumb. And I think Heidegger's got an insight there.
I want to go back to that failing part, because I want to get, so John contrasted Heideggerian approach to what the human being in the world is with a Cartesian approach to what the human being in the world is. I mean, for Descartes, the world is a problem. It's like, I got me, I've got my representations. Is there a world out there? Is there a body? How am I connected to it? And then he's got some arguments to solve the problem. But the world is first presented as a problem, right? It sounds like you're saying that for Heidegger, the world becomes a problem, if it ever does become a problem, it becomes a problem when things go awry, when things are interrupted, but the world is not first present to us as a problem?
No, it's not first present to us. We know our way around. What Dreyfus calls skillful coping, which is a very bad translation of umgehen. In any case, we know what we're doing when we're in the kitchen, we're in the classroom, etc. The world isn't a problem. It's something that we're living through. Now, breakdown, crisis, what John referred to, and you too, Ken. Yeah, tools can break down, and then we realize what the world of meaning is that we're living in. I got to hammer in those damn nails, right? What if you have a personal breakdown? Nothing makes sense. There's stuff still out there, but it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter. This is what he calls the experience of dread. All of a sudden, you realize that you are responsible for the meaning that you make, and that there is no reason, no ground, no explanation for why you're thrown ahead as a discursive, temporal, sense-making being.
So now Heidegger sounds like, this all sounds kind of cool to me. I haven't much thought hard about Heidegger. I've thought a lot more about the existentialist. I think I've become an existentialist in my old age, or something of an existentialist, except I guess I don't believe in radical freedom.
You're not old, Ken. I'm old. Okay, you're middle-aged.
Okay. Anyway, so what's the really... I mean, this kind of sounds... I know Sartre was influenced by Heidegger, but Heidegger thought Sartre misread him or something. What's the relationship between existentialism and Heidegger?
There are three stages in the reception of Heidegger. First, he was looked upon as an existentialist for 20 years, and Sartre was his sort of representative in the States. Secondly, beginning in the 60s, he was looked upon as a philosopher of being. And it's only with the book that is now published, Making Sense of Heidegger, that we realize that his whole philosophy is about making sense over our and because of our mortality. So Heidegger, the existentialist, is what perdures throughout all of his readings. And I maintain that the being phase, 40 years of discussion of being, was really a waste of time.
Wait a minute. It was a waste of time in Heidegger, or it was a waste of time in interpreters of Heidegger? I just clear that up.
First of all, two things. Heidegger was not clear. He was famously sloppy, I think, notoriously vague in his language. That's why books like mine have to be written, right? And he presented himself.
So you're glad he was like that.
Well, it took me 50 years to figure out what he was getting at, I would say. But he is an existentialist to the end, who's after not being, but how we make sense and why we make sense. And the reason why we make sense, he argues, is that we are mortal, finite, and have to put this world together for ourselves before we die.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the life and times, the life and philosophy of Martin Heidegger. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Sam from Riverside is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sam.
Hi. So earlier in the program, you were mentioning Heidegger's relationship with Edmund Husserl, his mentor, and I was wondering if you could say a bit about what ideas you think Heidegger took from Husserl and where Husserl and Heidegger tend to diverge.
Well, now, this is complicated because we don't really want to get into a whole discussion on Husserl, Tom, because that's a whole other program. But can you give us briefly a characterization of the relationship between Heidegger and Husserl for the uninitiated? I mean, Sam, our caller, seems like he's initiated, but we're talking mostly to uninitiated.
Right. Well, I would prefer to use the word phenomenology rather than continental philosophy. Heidegger learned phenomenology as a method from Husserl. And the The things that he keeps from Husserl are, number one, lived experience. That's the primary focus in phenomenology. Secondly, the logic of lived experience. There is a logic in phenomenology, right? But it's about pre-predicative experience. What's the logic of that? And thirdly, what is the ground of both the logic and the lived experience? That he inherits from Husserl. The notion that the mind is not locked in your head like a Cartesian closet, but it is all over the world, that intentionality is a notion that he gets from Husserl.
So, I want to ask you a question about Descartes and Husserl and Heidegger and all that, because I got the point, lived experience. Our lived experience is not of the world presented as a problem, right?
Yes.
But, you know, for Descartes to reach that stage, what he had to do was retreat to his study and engage in this elaborate intellectual discipline that got him some distance from his lived experience and got him the chance to examine his ideas critically and then probe them. And that's a distinctively philosophical mode of being. It's not everyday lived experience. So is there really such a deep, do the phenomenologists really fundamentally disagree with that Cartesian thought that if we retreat to the study and engage in a meditative discipline, we can, with struggle, be brought to, you know, achieve this distance?
Yes, they radically disagree with Descartes on that. Descartes is an Augustinian, basically. Go inside yourself is the Augustinian model. Rede ente ipsum in Latin, right? That's not at all what phenomenology is about. It's about being already out there and involved. It's Aristotelian rather than Augustinian.
I get that. What I'm asking is, though, Descartes kind of agrees with that as an account of everydayness, if he ever did have an account of everydayness. But philosophy is not about the everydayness. Philosophy is about this distinctive kind of discipline, right? So when you're in the mode of philosophizing, you're doing something different than having everyday lived experience.
Okay, let me disagree. I think that's one way of doing philosophy, to do the reduction back to the interior self, the Cartesian, the Augustinian self. Heidegger speaks of eduction, being led out into the world where we live, and then unfolding the meanings that are operative there. So it's only one way to do philosophy, a la Augustine and Descartes.
So that Augustine, Descartes, I think even Kant, think that there's a distinctive point. There's a really deep philosophical point to trying to recover this self, this Cartesian self, this transcendental ego, from the morass of the everyday, because now you get to see its true nature or something like that. You get to see what really moves reason or should move reason. Does Heidegger reject even that kind of project? Achieve this critical distance, then see where the weight of reason really lies?
I would disagree with your typification of Kant as part of that, but he certainly does disagree with the unnatural attitude of a Descartes or Augustine.
Yeah.
He does want to unfold meaning, but he's claiming that it's in the world that we find our meaning, not back inside of our heads in the closet of a Cartesian consciousness.
So
we have this idea that getting ideas is like the mind is a stomach, and we put in data, chew it up, and get representations. Heidegger's absolutely, phenomenology is absolutely against that unnatural act.
Yeah. So we don't want to get too technical here, but there is this phrase, transcendental ego. Sartre criticized Husserl on the issue of the transcendental ego. Husserl seems to have claimed there was a transcendental ego, which I guess means the self that is doing the phenomenology as opposed to the self that is disclosed in the phenomenology or something like that. Sartre disagreed, and I believe Heidegger did too. Is that?
Absolutely. Nobody, certainly no Husserlian, knows what the transcendental ego is. Mm-hmm. I defy any Husserlian to call us and tell us what that is. You know, it's an invention of Husserl because of Descartes. However, Heidegger says we're not transcendental egos. We're operating in the world. If you want Dreyfus's coping, that's where we live. Let's find out what's going on there.
But let me ask you another question. The world is a mess. It pushes us around in all kinds of ways. It pushes, puts urges on us. One of the things, I don't know about Descartes, but one of the things Kant believes in is that there is an autonomy to the will that's different from mere inclination, which comes from like empirical sources. There's pure reason moving the will and all that sort of stuff. I take it, I'm guessing, that Heidegger probably doesn't believe in anything like that.
Well, the world is a mess if you take it as simply the stuff out there. world means the meaningful stuff out there. There's where we already live. Mm-hmm. Okay. So for Heidegger, yeah, it's a mess, except that we're forever organizing it. Kant thought we organized it through categories. Hegel thought it was organized by absolute spirit. Heidegger thinks it's organized by our practical activity.
It turns out it's the NSA.
Yeah, yeah. But wait a minute, though. Help me more, Tom. I think we're getting somewhere deep, but help me more. Because, yeah, there are all kinds of proposed meanings out there. You're a meaning-generating creature. John's a meaning-generating creature. I'm another one. You guys throw these meanings at me. But isn't it kind of up to me to either accept or reject these meanings to make a meaning of my own in this kind of... I mean, what does he think about that? The contest over meaning.
Well, let's make a distinction. Aristotle's always making distinctions between meaning and truth, right? Everything is meaningful. Not everything is true. Even when I'm wrong, I'm meaningful, right? If I think that's a deer across the studio and it's not, well, that's meaningful, but it doesn't happen to be true. Heidegger is after, first of all, how we make meaning and why we have to.
But truth, though, sounds like... it's independent of my takings. There is a way the world is. And this sounds maybe I don't know what Heidegger thinks about truth. This sounds kind of maybe non-Heideggerian. I have thoughts. I take the world to be a certain way. I take you to be a deer. Oh, my God, you're not a deer. Nothing I can do can endow you with deerhoodness because there's a way you are independently of my takings. What does he think about that thought, that there's a way the world is independently of my takings, and it can embarrass my takings by saying, oh, that taking is false?
Oh, he's absolutely convinced of that. Of mm-hmm. course, the world's out there. There's no question about that. However, we do recognize that truth is no absolute. I don't always get it absolutely right. Because in 10 years, my graduate student will undo what I've done. So truth is evolving, right? And there are different ways that we talk about truth, right? But it's a subjective community that decides what the truth of subatomic particles is, not some absolute out there-ness.
Okay, so there is truth out there. How did you put it?
No, there's no truth out there. Truth is between me and what's out there.
Old-fashioned philosophical idea. Truth is correspondence to reality. So that's kind of sounds like there's an idea over here. There's a world out there. Those two things are different. If they match, then there's truth. If they don't match. But that doesn't sound very Heideggerian.
It is very Heideggerian.
Really?
Yeah. You find that in section 44 of Being in Time. However, the question of it's out there, I'm over here. Wait a minute. I'm constructing what's out there. I see a bunch of squiggles on my computer, and I say that's a meson, a subatomic particle, right? I've interpreted it that way. And in 10 years, somebody else will interpret it as not a meson, but a gluon. So we have no access to what's out there except in terms of our relation to what's out there. That's what the truth problem's about.
Okay, so to anticipate a little what we're going to discuss in the next section, Heidegger spent a lot of time thinking about Bolshevism, which he didn't much like, the kind of European point of view, which he saw as coming from classical Greece and being exemplified by Germany, and American capitalism. And he thought there was an objective difference between them, didn't he? Does truth extend to these kind of political ideologies? As I say, we'll talk a lot about this in a minute, but give us a quick answer.
A quick answer is he was absolutely naive about the political, sociological, economic structure of the modern world, including Bolshevism, Americanism, capitalism, etc. And I think he was absolutely stupid to pontificate on all of that without having done the labor of the concept. And actually, he betrays his phenomenology by making those kind of absurd generalizations.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Heidegger with Thomas Sheehan, author of Making Sense of Heidegger.
In the next part, we'll learn more about Heidegger's conception of humans in the world and also ask where morality fits, or the idea of a good life. Where does this fit or not fit in his system?
The right, the wrong, and Dasein, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Dasein, one of many important, difficult, but still very catchy concepts put forth by Martin Heidegger and turned into rock music for the improvement of life of all of us. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Thomas Sheehan from Stanford University, and we're thinking about the life and thought of Martin Heidegger.
So, Tom, you're a leading Heidegger scholar and expositor. You just finished a book offering what in many ways is a new interpretation. In a way, you spent 50 years on that book. You've been reading Heidegger. Now, Heidegger says the main benefit of his philosophy is an improved understanding of who you are and a deep understanding of your own life. So how do you think about your 50 years reading Heidegger? Do you think he was right that reading Heidegger improves your life?
No, actually, the only thing that improves your life is your living of your life, right? First live, then philosophize, said Seneca. And I think that's what we could learn from Heidegger.
But Heidegger was in the tradition, wasn't he, of the Greeks who thought that philosophy wasn't just a theoretical undertaking. It was about coming to live more authentically or better or more humanly.
Right. Heidegger's philosophy is finally an exhortation to live well. But does he cash out an answer to that exhortation? He's all about authenticity in the early writings. That is to say, become who you really are, to quote Pindar. But in Heidegger, while he does invite you to have that experience of awe and dread over the nothingness under your feet, the groundlessness of human existence, right, over which you make sense, he has no ethics at all. He never wrote an ethics and probably couldn't write an ethics because he had no social philosophy. Whatever he says about the social is generally negative. You know, you get pulled down into what he calls the common man, the crowd self.
But that's the problem with not just him, but the existentialist generally, it seems to me, right? But there is a thing, though. There is something about authentic selfhood in Heidegger, right? I mean, what is it to live, to be an authentic self, to live an authentic life? Help us think about that.
Bottom line, he wants you to live mortally, aware of the fact that you are thrown out over nothing into a sense-making thing, and that finally, you die. That's the bottom line.
That's this thing about being toward death, right?
Being towards death, and I think it's better translated as being ever on the edge of death. It's not like my death is up the road. Mm-hmm. It's right here haunting
me
now.
It's lurking at every corner.
Exactly. I mean, Eliot is great on that in Prufrock and other poems.
But help me think of why that should matter, that death lurks around every corner.
What he's concerned about is the total rationalization and technologization of everyday experience and life. We think that we can control everything. And there's no reason why we shouldn't try. But what he wants us to be aware of is a realism about our finitude and our mortality. That's the existential dimension of Heidegger that I think is probably the most important.
Well, I like that part of Heidegger insofar as I understand it. I've been working on a book on melancholy, and then the Riverside student Kevin Gibb and Sam Richards said, hey, Heidegger uses the word melancholy. So I was both thrilled and disappointed to find this out.
You were scooped?
Yeah, I've been scooped.
Actually, John, it's Sartre who uses the word melancholy. That was the first title of his book, of his novel, Nausea, and then he dropped it, right? Heidegger uses dread rather than melancholy.
But somehow between the part that I don't like, I mean, between the part that I like about his metaphysics and the part that I like about his existential philosophy, there seems to be this idea that for his authentic being, it meant identifying with the European point of view, the German point of view. I mean, does part of recognizing who you really are mean that you know, like I have to say, well, I'm really a Nebraskan, so I can't really reject my Cornhuskerian attitudes towards things? Was there a bit of self-deception there? How do these two parts of Heidegger fit together at all, this kind of nationalism and, in the worst case, Nazism, and this idea that you have to get meaning where you can?
Right. What's a polite word that one can use on radio? That's BS in Heidegger. It's Teutonic bombast. He's just a man of his times, and he was not able to distance himself from his Germanism, his nationalism. I hope we can leave that stuff aside. You know, that was definitely his shadow, and he could not jump over his shadow. But there should be a lesson for all of us about that. I mean, think of American anti-communism in the academy in the 1950s. Let's at least say 93% of all German professors signed on to Nazism in the 30s. It wasn't just Heidegger.
Yeah.
So it's a lesson for all of us about being embedded in our traditions and not being reflective. So I would leave all of that aside and say, no, we do, all of us, have the chance to look into that grave and say, that's me. Now let's get on with business. That's what I think Heidegger's about.
We've got a call from Mitt in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mitt.
It's Milt, M-I-L-T.
Oh, Milt. Okay.
Here is my problem with Heidegger, is trying to find out what Heidegger means by meaning. We here on Earth understand meaning as being ratified. We play the piano. We are in love. That's very palpable. And we say, that gives me meaning. Seems like Heidegger means something else by meaning.
So what do you think?
I don't think so. I think you've got it exactly right. Meaning has a number of layers. One is simply basic familiarity, what I call knowing our way around, what Dreyfus calls coping. And I think you're exactly right. Meaning, significance is ratified in the very doing of the act, whether it's playing piano, making love, being a friend, eating dinner. That's the kind of meaning that he's after. He's not talking about, although one can talk about, propositional, rational representations that we would call meaningful. Heidegger's saying we're swimming in meaning all the time.
And that seems deeply correct. And the kind of holism that he seems to me, as I understand it, gets into, because we're swimming in networks of meaning, right? But I want to take you back to, you easily threw off, and I understand the impulse, the Heidegger's fascination with the rising Nazi party. I don't know if you ever read Mein Kampf, because anybody who read that would not be fascinated by those folks. They would be repulsed. But, I mean, you think of the broken, defeated Germany and this voice rising up to instill, and that quote that we have, only in ourselves, only in themselves does the future of the German people lie, or something like that.
In the Führer.
Yeah. Well, didn't he say, he was referring to himself or
ourselves? No, he meant the Führer is our law. Yeah, he was awful.
Yeah, no, he was definitely awful. But you can see how, before you saw how terrible the guy was, he did something to the German people. And Heidegger's philosophy seems to me like it could be used to give some kind of intellectual foundations to a charismatic person who reinstills meaning in a broken, defeated people.
Yeah, that's definitely possible. And the core is what he calls historicity. That is to say, what do you pick out of your national and personal DNA to actualize in your future? He picked his own conservative political background. He picked Hitler. I would have picked Harry Bridges, and I think that would have gone with Heidegger. You could have picked Rosa Luxemburg.
Right.
His biography, not his philosophy, his biography made him pick Hitler.
But the act of picking a thing and enthusiastically living by it and endorsing it and full-heartedly owning it rather than shirking from it and running from it, that's a very Heideggerian-sounding act.
Well, look at Sartre. Sartre picked the Communist Party. He was never a member, but he was a fellow traveler. He did it passionately. He's the only philosopher I know that visited Cuba, right? So how do you make your decisions? The most important thing is to have chosen your mother and father wisely, and
so
Heidegger didn't.
So Heidegger's philosophy gives us a good understanding of the choices he had, and also a good understanding of the mistake he made.
Yeah, I think so. And he refused to acknowledge that mistake. He claimed he'd never done anything wrong. And by the way, Ken, he did read Mein Kampf. Part two, he thought was great. All the theory.
Yeah.
Part one, the life of Hitler, he thought was banal.
Mike in San Francisco, be brief, Mike, because you're going to be our last caller.
Hi, Mike, political science PhD from UC, and I'd like to suggest a possible answer to the question of Heidegger and Nazism. You have to think of him as a theorist rather than somebody who's analyzing practice. And I think that when he was looking at the theory of fascism or national socialism, he was following up on Hegel's idea of the organic state, that the individual could surpass or defeat his own mortality, which you correctly identify as one of his chief concerns, by becoming a member of the immortal organic state. And that was the reason for his fascination with this idea of a immortal super Germany, so to speak. And I'll stop right there. Take any comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks, okay. Mike. Good question.
Yeah, a lot of people have tried to find that organic fascistoid community in Section 74 of Being in Time. We don't have time, but I think that's really BS. It's not there. He reads it into that later from in the 1930s. But Immanuel Faye and other intellectually challenged types, Richard Wolin, have been trying to say that that is what Heidegger's about. It's not. Nonetheless, I'll say this. He was not absolved from knowing what was going on in Germany. He is at fault for that.
Well, but you know, but I think we got into something deep, because I think it's also true of the existentialist. Authenticity, making a choice, affirmatively living it, is not sufficient.
Absolutely.
Is not sufficient. And that's the thing they never really came to grips with.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But on the other hand, we don't want to turn ethics into whether I turn the trolley car this way and kill three people or that way and kill the fat guy. I mean, we don't have an adequate ethics in Heidegger, and I would maintain we're still looking for one, a social ethics in both analytic and phenomenological philosophy.
I totally agree with you. I think this is a really hard problem. And, you know, it does get to be where we see the limits of Heidegger's philosophy. But I do think... you've both convinced me that there's a lot there, nonetheless, that is worth deep thinking about.
Yeah, the last two chapters of this famous book that we're talking about, Making Sense of Heidegger, is all about his limitations. And I think his history of being is just doesn't compute. And I think that we have to look at the early stuff before 1930 for the real Heidegger.
So both Heidegger and Frege trace back to Lotze. And one wonders if Frege had written as obscurely as Heidegger and Heidegger as clearly as Frege, how different the 20th century philosophy would have been.
Heidegger should have learned something from the Aristotle that he loved so much, which was clarity.
So, Tom, this has been a fascinating conversation, but it has to come to a close. Now I'm going to thank you for joining us.
I want to thank both of you. Thanks.
Our guest has been Tom Sheehan. He's a professor of religious study at Stanford University, author of Making Sense of Heidegger, A Paradigm Shift. So, John, you got a brief thought now?
Yeah. Really now that I know that I am but design, I'm thinking things will turn out fine. First I'll be something, then I'll be nothing, and nothing away till the end of time.
Well, on that intriguing and cheerful. So you do understand the nothing-nuts.
Yeah, I've come to believe that not only nothing-nuts, but I'm going to spend a lot of time nothing.
Okay. This conversation, this scintillating conversation, continues at Philosopher's Corner. That's at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is very Cartesian and anti-Heideggerian. Cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that great one and that great community of thinkers by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second Dasein.
Ian Scholes, from time to time, philosophers become caught up in kerfuffles that may or may not have anything whatsoever to do with their philosophies. In the case of Heidegger, insinuations of Nazi sympathies do not seem to have had an overly dampening effect on his legacy. That's probably because he did not go around kicking in doors like a jackbooted thug. He was a philosopher. Any kicking was purely theoretical. Most modern folks, I suspect, only notice philosophers when they're Twitter fodder or some gossip item you read in the dentist's office in a six-month-old People magazine. Beyond being philosophers, they're generally French adulterers. We Americans don't go in for thinking. It just leads to trouble. Certainly when it comes to Heidegger, even if his rep was not besmirched, even if he were the tallest and best in a coterie of thoughtful angels, think of the sad fates of philosophers past. Spinoza, excommunicated as a Jew for his writings. Sir Francis Bacon, stripped of his office as Lord Chancellor and put in the Tower of London for corruption. Nietzsche stopped the beating of a horse in the street, then lapsed into silence, dementia, and death. What was that all about? And what was up with St. Augustine? According to some, he'd been quite the ladies' man before his conversion, but he didn't write about sex or murder in his confessions, but about the senseless theft of a bunch of pears. Yet those pears gave St. Augustine his notions of sin, which led to some mighty ferocious heresy hunting in the early Catholic Church. Then there's the Marquis de Sade, not much of a philosopher or a Catholic, certainly, but his gaudy writings give his sins permission to be. Hippies, libertarians, filmmakers, playwrights, and novelists have all dined richly in the feast that was the Marquis de Sade. If it feels good, do it. But thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Yet the Marquis de Sade spent most of his adult life in prison, and Ayn Rand wound up on Social Security, which does not seem to have diminished her stature as anti-big government goddess. Socrates, of course, for his sins, wound up being killed by big government. Schopenhauer knocked his cleaning lady down a flight of stairs because she was making too much noise, which did not diminish his stature as a cranky misogynist. Leibniz and Newton came up with calculus at the same time. Newton, being a prickly fellow, accused Leibniz of stealing it. As a result of that and other pieces of bad fortune, Leibniz was shunned by the King of England, and when he passed, the Royal Society pretended not to notice. Not only that, Voltaire mocked him cruelly in Candide as Pangloss, the optimistic philosopher believing that we live in the best of all possible worlds. Centuries later, Leibniz is just now getting his due. From the memoir of a friend of his, I learned that Immanuel Kant, in his waning days, became a frail old man who could barely summon the strength to fire his alcoholic manservant. It was embarrassing to read about. Nobody wants to see frailty from a big brain titan. But I also learned, according to the same memoir, that Kant did not perspire. So that's more like it. Think up a storm, avoid trouble, and never let him see you sweat. That's my advice to young philosophers. And another piece of advice, if you're looking to get advice, never take it from people like me. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018. Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
We must have some order here. Will all the dancing Hitlers please wait off stage right? And all the singing Hitlers off stage left?